From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Bord Yang, correspondent for The Times of London, Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News, and our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Hello, thank you for joining us. And here are the issues. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump moves into a new phase. Another Democrat has entered the race for president, former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. President Trump has fired his Navy secretary. It concerns a controversial decision by the president to reinstate a member of the Navy's elite SEALs. And will break down recent elections in Hong Kong, where pro-democracy candidates have scored major gains. Well, let's start with this impeachment inquiry into President Trump. A lot of developments, obviously, in recent days. And we'll start with you, Dan, including this announcement by the House Judiciary Committee that they're going to hold hearings next week.
That was certainly a major step, that on December 4th, there will be the start of hearings in the House Judiciary Committee. And that's the committee that's tasked with writing what are called articles of impeachment. So if this were a legal process in which an alleged criminal, you know, was being brought before judges and being put on trial, this would be actually writing the indictment. What are the crimes that Donald Trump will be charged with? And so far, this is entirely partisan. And because the Democratic Party has the majority in the House of Representatives, they're able to pretty much do what they want. They had hearings that all around the world, people saw bits, at least on television. And that was in the House Intelligence Committee, looking into how President Trump and people close to him handled Ukraine. Now in the House Judiciary Committee, we understand the hearings will start at least with trying to define what is impeachment. What are the misdeeds by an American president that could deserve impeachment and then being put on trial in the Senate? Now, because it's all partisan, because the Democrats have a majority, you know, whatever the content is of the hearings, it seems pretty clear that before Christmas, the House will vote to impeach the president. Only a majority vote is needed. The Democrats have that. And therefore, we think in January, there'll be a trial, which is very dramatic. It's only the third time in U.S. history a president's been put on trial in the U.S. Senate. A two-thirds vote in the U.S. Senate would convict the president and remove him from office. But the Republicans have the majority, and there is no sign in the U.S. Senate of any Republican voting against Trump, let alone 20 Republicans crossing over and voting with Democrats. So everyone assumes that the president will be acquitted in the Senate trial, and mainly we wonder what the political impact will be, whether this whole process will actually damage President Trump and his chance of being reelected next year, or maybe even help him because he'll boast that he survived the impeachment process.
Now, Dan, you've given the whole answer right there, but when people say what can the president be impeached for, that's what the Republicans say. They say, well, he hasn't done anything, and yet impeachment, as President Gerald Ford famously said 40-plus years ago, well, it's whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at any given moment in time. And Democrats now have a long list of things that they say meets that threshold, everything from obstruction of justice, 10 instances in the Mueller report, even obstruction of Congress for not producing witnesses and documents and this and that, to witness intimidation, all of these things that they say constitute articles of impeachment.
Yeah, I mean, the list has certainly gotten longer since the public impeachment hearings started earlier this month, with President Trump, you know, tweeting things he probably shouldn't be tweeting while people are testifying, more disclosures coming out about this whistleblower report and the president essentially withholding military aid in exchange for asking for some help from the Ukrainians to find politically embarrassing information about his rival, Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter, who had worked at a Ukrainian energy company, at least from the Democratic perspective. That's the big argument that they're making. But as Dan pointed out earlier, it is a sort of still politically risky thing to go through with impeachment, because from the Republicans' perspective. They say, well, you know, the aide was released. What are you going to impeach him for? He didn't actually do the things that he's being alleged to have done. It's a democratic narrative, quote unquote, to say that he intimidated witnesses by sort of, you know, making these threats on Twitter against the former Ukrainian ambassador by sort of it's his right to withhold information if he wants to because of this, quote unquote, executive privilege, which was a defense that Nixon also used.
But the aide was released, it's believed, only when the president found out, in fact, that this whistleblower was complaining about it.
And there's even a new report that the president knew about the complaint when he decided finally to give the military aid to Ukraine. And Boram, I'm wondering, you know, this VOA program mostly has a global audience, and they're used to hearing news about all the countries on Earth, Ukraine, Kyiv. Americans aren't used to that. So I'm thinking that in the past month where the hearings about things that President Trump allegedly acted wrongly, it was about how he treats Ukraine and whether he was giving foreign aid. I don't think Americans necessarily follow the details.
I think you're absolutely right about that. And if you look at the numbers for how many people actually tuned in to the first week of hearings, you know, it was nothing like Watergate, where 80 million Americans, you know, were sort of watching this history unfold. It was something like 13 million Americans for the first day, 13 million for the second day. And I think some of that is borne out in the polling that we've seen. As you pointed out earlier, Dan, it's still a very partisan impeachment process where Republican voters are sticking very much with Trump, even though we see that a lot of Democrats and a lot of independents say, wow, that this is wrongdoing, this is impeachable.
But, you know, whether or not people are watching the hearings, the polls indicate that about half of Americans do want the president to be impeached. And some of the polls even say, do you want him removed? And still, it's almost half. And so I don't think it's because of the evidence on the Ukraine case. I think it's because how Americans feel about the president, and it's a sharply divided country.
I mean, half the country felt, even before these impeachment hearings, half the country felt that way about him. Anyway, so if nothing else, it's simply, my sense is, it's simply reinforcing the views that people brought to the table to begin with. Well, let's move on. Another Democrat has entered the race for president. That could probably fill up a football stadium at this point, but it's a former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Boy, let's start with you. Tell our listeners about Mr. Bloomberg.
So it's quite interesting that the former mayor of New York, this very rich man, another rich man from New York, can you imagine one of those becoming president, has jumped into already a very crowded Democratic primary field. And part of it is that there's a lot of nervousness, despite the fact that there's so many Democratic candidates already on hand, that there's not a clear winner that people are enthusiastic about. Joe Biden, the front runner, has had difficulty with fundraising. People don't necessarily seem excited about him because he's such an entrenched politician. He's been in politics for a long time. Meanwhile, the other two front runners, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, a lot of people are nervous that they're running on a platform that is quite left wing. They want to basically come in and completely change the system. They've promised all sorts of big social programs, lots of spending, and that makes many people very nervous that middle America is not ready for that. So Mr. Bloomberg is coming in. I think he thinks that he has a chance to sort of capture that independent, sort of moderate Democratic vote. He's had quite a checkered history as a politician, going from being a Democrat to being a Republican when he was serving as mayor, and then becoming an independent and back to being a Democrat. And he's quite an executive who's very data focused. His motto is trust in God, everyone else bring data. He's so sort of meticulous and specific that it's rumored that he signed off on the heights of the desks, you know, at his new headquarters in London. I think the point of him jumping in the race and another centrist jumping in the race, Deval Patrick, the former governor of Massachusetts, is that there is a bunch of nervousness about the primaries and who actually can capture the energy as well as the votes in the general election.
Now, one thing, Dan, that's interesting about Bloomberg, his wealth is estimated, I think, at about $54 billion American dollars, billion with a B. And, of course, there's a phrase in the United States that money is the mother's milk of politics. He has, by far more than anyone, has no need to go out and raise money from anyone. And he is intending, from what I'm reading, to spend tens of millions of dollars of his own money. It's nothing to him. He can stay in the race for as long as it takes. And to Boer's point, all these other candidates, maybe not setting voters on fire with their enthusiasm or anything. How could someone with that kind of money and staying power, is that a possible game changer?
Well, in the left-leaning Democratic Party, it's hard to believe that a man whose main attribute is being wealthy could be popular. And that's why I don't think he's likely to win in this process of the primaries from state to state to state, a process that begins this coming February. I don't think he's likely to win. But people who like Bloomberg, they say, oh, just wait till you hear him. Just wait till he does take part in a debate. Right now, he hasn't qualified for any of the debates. He's missed five of them. So he really is, you know, behind in the race. But if he's in a debate, he will show that he is sensible, that he is centrist. He's obviously good with money. And Paul, as you point out, he doesn't need contributions. He apparently doesn't plan to take any contributions from the public. And that's why, indeed, he could stay in the race the whole time he's going to see whether he has a chance. He probably doesn't like to waste money. But there was another little odd thing, because you may know he owns a news agency that has a TV channel and a worldwide radio network and one of the most important sources of business news, the Bloomberg News Service. And so within that news service, a decision was announced that Bloomberg, the news service, won't cover Bloomberg, won't actually get into the Democratic Party race, won't do investigations, won't do background stories. But at the same time, they will keep covering President Trump, which seems kind of unfair. They'll be covering the negatives, let's say, of the Trump administration, but not saying anything about their own boss and the other Democrats. So that's a strange situation here, that someone who heads a media organization wants to become president. And there will be a lot of Americans who feel uncomfortable with that. But again, friends of Bloomberg say, just wait till you see him in a debate. He's so smart, so sensible, so centrist that he really could be attractive.
Now, if he were to, this no coverage thing is interesting, were he to win the nomination next summer, then, of course, what would they do? Because you'd have this, it'd be down to Trump and Bloomberg and the debates and everything. What are they going to do, not cover him in a general election?
I guess the Bloomberg News Service would cover him and maybe would question people on Wall Street, what do you think is the impact of the race and all that, but somehow be hands-off and not make it appear like he's using his news service. Hey, when it comes to Donald Trump, he doesn't own the media, but when you watch some of the conservative media in this country, it's pretty much like he owns it.
Yeah. Well, let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Boer Dieng, correspondent for the Times of London. Dan Raviv, senior Washington correspondent for I-24 News. And our moderator is Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for USA Today.
Welcome back. Navy Secretary Richard Spencer has been fired. This after it was learned that Spencer was trying to resolve a standoff between the Pentagon and White House over a member of the elite Navy SEALs. The Navy wanted to get rid of the SEAL. His name is Eddie Gallagher. We've since learned that Gallagher will, in fact, retire shortly from the Navy. Now, he was convicted of dishonoring the military by posing next to a dead ISIS fighter's body. That is against military regulations. He was also demoted for that and acquitted in a separate case of murder. It's all very kind of complicated and a bit. The president reversed Gallagher's demotion. Military officials launched a formal review to determine if he was fit to serve, which is protocol after a conviction. Dan, this kind of thing, almost unprecedented in sort of annals of American military and their cooperation with an American president. I've never quite heard of a case like this.
Well, intervening in a particular case, yeah, I haven't heard of it about it either. But keep in mind that in the United States, the president is often called the commander-in-chief, meaning that's his role in the U.S. military, despite being a civilian. So he can do whatever he wants. It is legal, and he decided decided to intervene. He heard about the case of this Navy SEAL, a commando fighter, who had served in both Iraq and Afghanistan. His name is Eddie Gallagher, and Eddie Gallagher became kind of a cause célèbre on some of the conservative media. Here's this hero who's being brought down, who's being put before a court-martial because he killed a terrorist and then posed for photographs with that young terrorist's body. I say young because, well, apparently the alleged terrorist, an ISIS fighter, was a teenager. He'd been wounded. He was being treated by a U.S. medic when, according to witnesses, Eddie Gallagher came up and killed that fellow and then posed for the photo. All of that does seem like a violation of military discipline, and that's what Gallagher was convicted of. But when President Trump heard about the case, he said, no, I'm going to take Gallagher's side. And just the week before, less noticed, perhaps less controversial, the president had offered a pardon in one case and clemency in another, again, intervening in two courts martial on behalf of soldiers. The president said, I'm always going to take the side of the warrior. So President Trump may sincerely feel that. And in addition, he thinks it's good for his image and good for him politically. So the Navy secretary was trying to be a normal civilian executive at the Defense Department, and he objected, tried to cut a deal, something of a compromise. The president thought, when he learned about that, that's outrageous, and forced Richard V. Spencer to resign. Spencer later saying, the president doesn't seem to understand. If you're an American fighter, there are rules. There's discipline. There's integrity. And the president doesn't understand that. So it's another case in which people are accusing Trump of being unconventional and ruining some of the norms.
Well, Spencer wrote this extraordinary farewell letter where he said that Trump was undermining, and I'm quoting here, the key principle of good order and discipline. Spencer, of course, I believe was actually appointed by President Trump, so not some one of these deep state bureaucrats that we're always hearing about. Yeah, and he also said, Boren, I'll get you to respond to this. Spencer, in his letter, said, I cannot in good conscience obey an order that I believe violates the sacred oath I took in the presence of my family, my flag, and my faith to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. The implication being that the president does not share those values.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite an astonishing and damning resignation letter, as you point out, Paul, someone that Trump himself appointed. And it, not only does Richard Spencer feel this, but the president has definitely gotten some backlash from sort of rank-and-file members of the military saying, look, you know, this undermines the oath that we took, from legal experts who say, look, this kind of extraordinary intervention upends the legal system under which military discipline is supposed to be enforced, and it sort of takes away from the laws of engagement and warfare that's supposed to sort of define what we do as soldiers, and makes it so that there's a feeling that, you know, there are exceptions to the rule, that there's no sort of unified standard, and that's damaging not just in this case for morale, but in the long run in terms of, well, what is the system that we're upholding? But as Dan pointed out, Mr. Trump does act in this way often, where he likes to take up exceptional causes and point to them and say, look, you know, I've got this thing done and it's people who support me. My supporters really like it. You know, whether it's criminal justice reform and he's sort of pardoning a particular woman or a particular case that he's seen on Fox News, or, you know, doing something like this without sort of thinking about the bigger implications.
But more, some of that is in the United States. So many of those cases, the kind that you mentioned, this is a worldwide image issue, right? The U.S. forces all around the world, how do they behave? Do they respect the rules of war, or do they do whatever they want? And President Trump's view seems to be that in a war against terrorist groups such as ISIS, there are no rules. I just want tough guys out there fighting.
Spencer has said that it's the rule of law, in fact, that separates us from the rest of the world. So this is sort of a battle over perhaps image and perception and how we're seen around the world. Let me take a step back, though, on that theme. You know, Dan, it seems that the president been in office for about 3 years now. He has really taken on, according to some at least, say, undermined, but at least challenged now the military. In the past, he's challenged the intelligence community, the judiciary's pillars of our American system. What do you make of that?
Well, I've spoken with friends of President Trump. Every few months, I kind of check in. You know, how do you think your guy is doing? And early on in his presidency, it began in early 2017, they were focused on the economy. And they said, look, the stock market's going up. Look, the business world likes this. Now, in the past few months, they're uncomfortable with the trade dispute with China, with a high level of tariffs. They fear that can be damaging. And as for President Trump's tendency to not respect the norms, to be unconventional, I'm finding that supporters of the president still like that, that he's different.
I think it's the same thing. I was at a Trump's campaign launch, and you know, people were queuing up for days outside getting into this. And I think, to your point, Dan, what people care about, it tends to be how the economy is doing, how things that affect their day-to-day life have changed under one president or another. And I think that's part of the reason why when he goes out and does these unconventional things, supporters of the president just generally find it to either be something like, yeah, we've got to have a tough guy, or something that they don't pay a whole lot of attention to because it doesn't affect their life in a very direct way. And I think that, you know, that goes back to the other things that we've been talking about with impeachment, with this president breaking norms. It doesn't affect the average voter in a way that would cause them to pay a whole lot of attention or to be very exercised about
it. Or be disturbed about
it. Exactly.
And again, that's perhaps about half of America.
Exactly.
I've certainly spoken with a lot of people, including Republicans, who say, well, I don't like his tweets. I wish he wouldn't be so rude and so crass. But on the other hand, have you seen the economy? Mm-hmm. I hear it all the time.
It is true that people tend to vote on issues that are nearest and dearest to them. That's usually the economy. Yet there's sort of a projection by the Federal Reserve that some of these key states that Trump barely won in 2016 and he's going to need again next year, they're actually predicting not just a slowdown, but a contraction in the economy in places like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, all three key states that the president had. Yet, if you look at the polls on a state-by-state basis, they show, as both of you had said, the president is holding up quite well in these polls. So even though the economies of those states looks a little shaky.
One reason for that is because we don't know who the Democratic Party candidate will be and whether that man or woman will look like someone who's very capable to improve the economy or, as you said, Boris, someone who's thought of as a socialist, and that doesn't sit well with many Americans.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's move on. We've got a couple of minutes left here. In Hong Kong, pro-democracy candidates have won a stunning victory in local elections there, winning 86% of seats. Turnout was reported to be very heavy, about 70% of people voting there. Now, Boris, this is something that's sort of in your lane. This appears to be, I think, a clear rebuke of Beijing and its allies in Hong Kong itself.
Yeah, and Beijing clearly understands that. I mean, it was just reported that their senior political appointee in Hong Kong is going to be recalled and they're going to replace him with someone else. You know, President Xi stood with Carrie Lam, the chief executive in Hong Kong, to sort of show a bit of support, but there's questions over, you know, how strong really is that support. Carrie Lam has had to come out after these very embarrassing elections. As you point out, Paul, pro-democracy candidate, won 17 out of 18 of the local districts, basically a slaughter at the polls. And Carrie Lam has had to come out and say that she's willing to sort of compromise and, you know, try and find a new way of governing, though she says that, you know, she can't give any more concessions given the protests that have been happening in recent weeks that became increasingly violent until there was this police siege at Hong Kong Polytech University. It's a question of what Beijing does next. And they're clearly very nervous. They've set up a villa outside of Shenzhen to try and sort of coordinate the activities. It's a very tense situation. But as you say, it's clearly a rebuke of Beijing. Hong Kong being a very important financial center has to sort of be dealt with very delicately. And clearly Hong Kongers and their concerns about universal suffrage, about police brutality, about how these things are dealt with will have to be dealt with.
And Dan, there's an American angle here too. Congress, both the House and the Senate, have passed legislation that backs these pro-democracy demonstrators in Hong Kong. President Trump at one point hinted that he might actually veto that. He's under pressure not to. What's he going to do?
Well, it was bipartisan in Congress to take the side of the protesters and not of the government in Beijing. But the president often says that he feels that he is good friends with the president of the People's Republic of China, Xi Jinping. And so just even this past week, President Trump did make an extraordinary claim. He said President Xi would have sent in Chinese troops. There would have been more brutality in Hong Kong if not for me. President Trump was claiming that he had counseled Beijing not to use violence. The word that Trump has used has been humane, to be humane, and I hope they solve it. Obviously, President Trump is not getting into the details. I'm not sure he would understand the various parties, but it's a matter of image, and so he says, I don't want China to crack down. And so, again, President Trump at least has taken a view on that. Would he veto the congressional measure? Okay, I don't want to guess, but if you think about what's there, sometimes Congress passes something that doesn't have teeth. It's just a resolution. It's kind of the opinion of the Congress of the United States. So why should the president block that? I mean, the United States stands for freedom. It's a delicate thing, especially when we're in a big trade dispute with China and negotiations continue.
We'll have to end it right there. Thanks to two of Washington's most prominent journalists, Bo Deng, she's the correspondent for the Times of London, and Dan Raviv, he's with Israel's I-24 News. This program was produced by Kim Lewis, our engineer, Justin Thwaites, and I'm Paul Brandis of USA Today and West Wing Reports. Thanks for joining us.